this is Johnny Bluestar. Welcome to Threshold, a global media event. Is the universe just a random dance of atoms? Or is it a manifestation of a supremely intelligent architect? Can its purpose, or our purpose here on Earth, be adequately assessed? Can we commune with it, know its intentions, cooperate with its direction? Here, we define Threshold as a gateway state of awareness, allowing mankind to cross into a place of real cognition. Threshold allows us to approach questions of higher reality through the door of experience rather than mere belief. Welcome to Threshold, where we tear away the veil from commercial media, bringing our audience and participants into another realm of reality and enhanced communication. Today, I am overwhelmingly excited to have connected with Kenneth Eadie, an attorney, author, and environmental activist. As some of you out there may know, my father was an attorney who continually assisted helping many people pro bono, especially to protect their civil liberties. I grew up with a man who really became my hero. I witnessed one of his best moments in a police brutality trial in Suffolk County when he defended the victim of an organized campaign by several police to intimidate African Americans. They would stop them, you know, from minor violations, and then, in this case, they brutalized this poor man and his wife. They maced him. They beat him up. He had to go to the hospital. And later on, as I saw in the court, they actually doctored the records that happened in the hospital somehow. Anyway, in the year that he retired, he defended victims of police brutality in four separate trials. I think my father, if he were alive today, would appreciate the work of my guest, who in his legal battles and books fights against tyranny and injustice every day. Ken, welcome to Threshold.
Thank you, Johnny. Thanks for having me on the program. Sounds like your father was a great man.
He was not a famous lawyer, but he fought in the ranks with many, many other people during the civil rights movement. He went down to the Mississippi Summer Law Project, which was handled by SNCC, to assist civil rights workers during the time that, you know, those various workers, those four workers, were murdered. So he was somebody who fought there.
I couldn't help but think when during your introduction about the Sandra Bland matter and the Michael Brown matter and how maybe your father could have made a difference in the fight against police brutality today.
Yeah, it's something. Anyway, in almost all of our programs, Ken, we're concerned about an individual's growth in consciousness and awareness. Obviously, we will soon find out in detail your social conscience has been awakened some time ago, as evidenced by your career as an attorney, environmentalist, and novelist, focusing on social and political problems. Did your life as a child provide any impetus in this direction?
I guess you could say that it did, because I got a little different perspective during my childhood, because I was brought up not only in the United States, but when I was about 8 years old, my family moved to Athens, Greece, and we lived there for about 3 years. So when I came back, I had a little different perspective on things, because I'd seen the world from a different point of view. And I was kind of treated like a stranger in my own country, like a foreign person, which was weird for me, but I was different than everybody because of my experience. And that kind of led me to inspire me to write Killer.com, which is my latest novel that exposes the issue of cyberbullying.
Ah, well, tell us a little about how your general experience as a practicing attorney gave you a deeper insight into some of the injustices prevailing right now, of which there are many, I may add.
Oh yeah, there's plenty, and as an attorney, you see a lot of things that people don't see in the media. You see a lot of things that people don't see in their everyday lives, because people are coming to you with real problems. You learn about civil rights in law school, and you learn what they are and how to recognize a violation of civil rights, but you don't actually see it happening until you get out there in the real world. I remember the first year I was practicing, and a guy came in to me for a basic drunk driving case, and he showed me the pictures that he had taken of his well, actually showed me his wrists and his ankles. And during the time he was held in police custody, they had hogtied him with handcuffs. So it showed me firsthand, you know, how police can get out of hand and violate a person's rights and have no respect for a person who's been accused of a crime. And you're supposed to be, you know, you're supposed to be presumed innocent, right?
Yeah, certainly. Although that's becoming rarer, I believe. Ken?
Yeah, I'm here. Yeah, it opened my eyes to a lot of things.
By now, you've written 5 legal thrillers in the Brent Mark series and 2 in the Seth Rogen Involuntary Spy Espionage series. Also, 3 in the nonfiction series, 2 on bees and 1 on saving the monarch butterfly. None of these novels are pure fiction. Instead, they are meant to inform and perhaps even stimulate the public on matters of needing social and political reform. Was there any one catalyst that spurred you on to this direction?
Yeah, there was. It's a little insect called the bee. Kind of strange that a bee got me involved in my second career of writing. But how it happened was my wife and I were celebrating our second anniversary wedding in San Francisco a few years ago. And we were sitting in the hotel dining room at breakfast and saw a notice that the hotel was keeping bees on the roof and hives because of the bee crisis. And at that time, I thought the bee crisis was over. I thought it had been solved. But then I started to poke into it and discover that it had only gotten worse. And my wife got inspired because she's a photographer, and she wanted to do an environmental photographic exhibition to make people aware of the problems facing the bees. Her idea was, you know, if we could show them the bee up close and personal, and not something that just buzzes around your, you know, and people run away and think it's going to sting them, then people might care more about them. So I was inspired by this to do more research into the plight of the bees, and that's what resulted in my first book, which is called Bless the Bees, and its children's counterpart, which is ABC, Who Are Our Pollinators and Why Are They in Trouble? And that one I'm particularly proud of because it's been used as second-grade curriculum material in Baltimore public schools. So after these 2 nonfiction books, I started to go into fiction, and I wrote my first novel surrounding the issue of genetically engineered foods. It's called An Involuntary Spy, and he's got me going on that as well.
You know, my wife was saying that a while ago, when the bee crisis became somewhat in the news, she was in McDonald's or something, and she saw these little bees like struggling, and you know, like they could hardly climb up the window, and they were like obviously dying. And you know, I thought that the whole thing had disappeared too. And why is that? Why would we both sort of have an impression that it was solved?
I think it's just that the media didn't alert us to the fact that it was still going on, because no one really made a fuss about it, and that's why we really wanted to make a big point about it so everybody would know. Because bees are more important than just, you know, honey. They pollinate most of our fruits and vegetables, and without them we wouldn't have a balanced diet, basically, and that's the selfish part. I mean, they contribute an essential part to every ecosystem on Earth, basically, except the ones in the sea.
Wow. Well, do you think that, I mean, the only person I've actually ever heard speak of this in the last few years was Linda Moulton Howe. Mm-hmm. And what will it take? Doesn't it require much more than just sort of sitting back and knowing about it? How can something be done? Why is the media so silent about this?
And they can be done on the individual level. First of all, the basic problem about that's facing the bees is the one that's facing us as well, and that's the fact that since the World War II, our food production has been basically produced by chemicals. We went from family farming, we went from conscious, responsible farming to chemical farming. instead of putting regular fertilizer on the ground, organic fertilizer to replenish the nutrients in the soil, we're using chemical nitrogen fertilizer. We're killing off the entire, all the weeds and all the things that we classify as pests or bugs with pesticides. And the fact of the matter is, we need bugs. We need bugs and we need weeds too. It's part of the ecosystem that we really can't do without. So this is where we went wrong, and this is where a lot of people are making profits, and we're being the guinea pigs and not getting the quality of food anymore.
Wow, that's really amazing.
It is.
You know, I'm gonna quote from the beginning of your book, Bless the Bees, which reiterates some of the points you made before the break. The bees have survived over 100 million years of evolution, but it's taken us less than 30 days to endanger them to the point of extinction. Bees are responsible for pollinating 60% of the world's food supply and 90% of all flowering plants. Without them, the human race would face starvation. One of every three bites of food comes from plants pollinated by honeybees and other pollinators. Without bees to pollinate our food, we would have had a worldwide food and economic epidemic. It has been called the bee apocalypse by Russia's president, but it is worse in the United States than any other country. Could you describe the dimensions of this bee apocalypse?
Yeah, I mean, it's pretty scary. If you remember, I don't know if you know the quote from Albert Einstein, but he's attributed the bee to having said, if the bee disappears from the earth, man would have no more than 4 years to live. And what he meant by that was the bees are an indicator species. In fact, scientists think now that the bees are warning us of an upcoming mass extinction. That means when a large amount of species are basically wiped off the earth, when almost everything's wiped off the earth that's alive, basically, and something else takes over. To put that in the perspective, the last mass extinction we had on the earth was 65 million years ago when the dinosaurs died. And this mass extinction is being caused by us, by mankind. And so the bees are warning us that, you know, if we see them weakening, they're the first weak link, and they're warning us that we've got to do something if we want the world to stay the way it is as we know it. Otherwise, it's going to change and we may not be in it anymore.
Wow. That's pretty serious. You know, we're going to play a song now. It's called Look What You Have Done. It was inspired by, it's by Stephanie Slovane and was inspired by a blues singer. These days, I think maybe we should have sing it to some of our politicians, looking at our country and the people who are supposed to be loved and cared for. A very sad song, but also brilliant and touching.
Look what you have done to this little child of mine. Look what you have done, for your darkness has gone blind. You broke and starved her body, and I freed you from your sin. But look what you've done to this child of mine, 'cause you let the darkness in. You cannot be saved, for I gave you a last chance. But you chose the path to darkness, and you did the devil's dance. Oh, look what you have done to this little child of mine. Look what you have done, for your darkness has gone blind. Forever in her sorrow, her happiness a show. Little broken girl, nobody wants to know. And I did always love her since the age of birth. But she could not feel my love, for she felt she had no worth. Oh, look what you have done to this little child of mine. Look what you have done, for your darkness has gone blind. And you can see her torment as she cries out in the rain. And I can feel her pain as she always calls my name.
In Manhattan is a coming-of-age novel by Ray Boylan and Johnny Bluestar. It is about a young Tom Boots Raymond who grows up in New York in the 1940s, who's a member of a street gang.
My friends and I were about to start our own game of stickball when Rabbit Lacey, the head of the Rattlers, came up to us and tried to move in on our game. We were called dwarves, the youngest members of the stupid gang.
Hey, Kevin, I need you to get some gloves and some stuff I left at my place.
No, this is our game.
Hey, are you my good little dwarf or what?
You've been calling me a dwarf since I was six. We're not your personal slaves, pal.
Hey, what is this? A dwarf rebellion? All right, big guy. We ditch the dwarf thing. We make you guys regular rattlers.
No, it's too late.
He looked at Jay and me. We looked away. Rabbit was now angry, and he pushed Kevin hard with the palms of his hand. Kevin tried to ram him in the stomach, but he stepped aside, throwing Kevin into the curb where he fell to the ground, bleeding profusely at the knee. Still, he managed to get up.
My street.
Kevin shouted at Rabbit, pointing at him with an angry index finger.
Find out more by Googling Boots in Manhattan, a 1940s coming-of-age novel, part one of the novel series The Foot Soldier by Ray Boylan and Johnny Bluestar. Google with the words Boots in Manhattan, Ray Johnny Kendall. That's Boots in Manhattan, Ray Johnny Kendall.
Nowadays, if you are a serious business person, just getting assistance from someone with a license and a bit of experience may not be sufficient. In fact, your realtor actually needs to be knowledgeable enough to be one of your top advisors. Whether you are facilitating a giant merger or selling your company, there's a lot at stake besides your finances. There is the future value of your current investment, financial freedom, integrity, and overall reputation. If you need this kind of assistance, Sandra LaFlamme is a real estate expert with the experience, reputation, and knowledge qualified to assist you in all your key transactions. Sandra LaFlamme, real estate services with integrity and conscience. Contact her today at 888-366-8070. That's Sandra LaFlamme at 888-366-8070. Hi, Ken. You know, we're now about to examine a little bit about your book called A Patriot's Act, which is about illegal detention and torture. It's hard to believe, given what I think we both believed when we were younger, that there could be a national debate about such an absolutely despicable practice.
Yeah, it's impossible to believe, really. I mean, especially growing up in the Vietnam era, where I saw all these protests against, what people thought was something that should not be prosecuted in their name. And I certainly don't want to be known as an American who supported the Guantanamo Bay Detention Center and what went on there.
There just seems so many questions about that place. I've read about it fairly often, and it's just hard to believe. Now, one of the parts of that unfortunate situation has been going on just not there, but all over the world, and that is torture and sanctioned at one point, legally, supposedly, by the United States. Whether it's going on now or not, it may be a matter of discussion. But it's painful to me, particularly in the lifelong respect I had for my father's belief in civil liberties, that a country prized for at least the inherent fairness of many of its principles and laws could descend to the level of systematic torture, illegal detention, and prisoner abuse. Perhaps we could go into a bit of discussion about how this practice first descended onto our political and legal landscape. Could you give us a thumbnail history of our legal descent into justifying and promoting torture as an actual policy of the United States?
Yes, well, torture and cruel and humiliating and degrading treatment is prohibited by the Geneva Conventions of 1949 and protocols of the Geneva Conventions of 1977. So what had to be done is that we had to, Bush and his cronies had to get away from the fact that the Constitution of the United States prohibits certain treatment of people, whether they're accused of a crime, and that the Geneva Conventions prohibits abuse of people that are considered to be prisoners of war. So to get around this, they decided, well, we don't have to worry about the Constitution if we're doing this. And then they have the problem, well, how do we get around the Geneva Convention? So they actually called their legal team at the Justice Department into work on this to try to argue that somehow we could go out and capture and kill people who were suspected to be terrorists as part of the war on terror, because there was some kind of a emergency exception to all these laws that had been basically made after the atrocities of World War II. So what began was a series of memos by the Justice Department and the people that Bush appointed to the Justice Department that said that, oh, this is okay. For example, in 2001, 6 days after September 11th, Bush signed a secret finding empowering the CIA to capture, kill, or interrogate al-Qaeda leaders. And he also established a secret global network of facilities to detain and interrogate them. That's what we call the Black Ops Centers. There was actually one in Guantanamo where they used certain enhanced interrogation techniques, which we know now because of the congressional report that they were torture. Exported some of these techniques to Abu Ghraib, so that's where they started, in Guantanamo, believe it or not.
It's interesting to me that some of these enhanced interrogation techniques were used by the North Vietnamese by the communists to get our prisoners of war to confess the crimes they didn't actually commit. So there is this kind of brainwashing doesn't necessarily lead to correct information. I'm not saying that correct information is the only reason not to torture or not to torture, but why would they use techniques that they knew historically had led people to make false confessions and say things that weren't true? It's an interesting idea, huh?
It is interesting, but I can answer that. And the reason why they did that was they thought that these people would never make it to a U.S. court. There would never be a real court that would decide their case. They would never be able to defend themselves, and they would never have due process. So they thought they could use these coerced confessions against them in order to convict them and execute them. And, thankfully, thank God, the Supreme Court disagreed with them. But, you know, not to the extent that Guantanamo was wiped out completely, because there's still 114 people there.
Yeah, it's pretty strange.
It's bizarre.
The idea of torture is, of course, you're torturing somebody who has not been convicted of a crime.
The Justice Department, like Attorney General Patrick Philbin and John Yoo, also Jay Bybee, who's right now a federal Ninth Circuit Court justice, saying that you know, federal courts have no jurisdiction over these cases. They can't review any cases, and international laws don't apply because it's the war on terror. And this led the ground, these memos saying that all this stuff was okay led the groundwork for the abuses in all the U.S. military prisons all over the world.
Yeah, I believe that the Constitution was promising, you know, equal justice for all. And all men, that, like the famous statement of Jefferson, all men are created equal. Now, if all men are created equal, then you would think that people in America would want everybody who got pulled into their little situation, even because of crimes, would still be entitled to the same basic concept of justice as everyone else, because they're human beings and they are men or women. But the
thing is, Johnny, that they objectify these people. They accuse them of being a terrorist, and as a matter of fact, most of these guys who were accused of being terrorists and who were being held in Guantanamo were actually sold to the U.S. authorities by bounty hunters for like $500,000. So they were just in the wrong place at the wrong time. But since there's such a fervor over September 11th, and I remember when it happened, I cried. I really cried. I was proud when I heard Bush say he was going to go into Afghanistan, he was going to find the terrorists. I said, yeah, go get those terrorists. But that's the mentality behind it. That's how people think. They don't think this person has been accused of something. They think right away, this is a terrorist. When the Constitution of the United States says that you're presumed innocent until you're proven guilty, and you have the right to due process, right?
Yeah, of course. Or it used to be, of course.
It used to be, of course, but now I guess you're not. And the first thing the Bush administration tried to do was abolish habeas corpus, which was actually the first right, the first guarantee of a right we had in the Constitution that's not in the Bill of Rights. It's right in the Constitution. And that gives us a right to go before a judge and say, look, I've been wrongly accused, I'm being held in prison, and I should be let out. And finally, after several years, the Supreme Court said, look, these guys are entitled to habeas corpus. You guys were wrong. So a lot of them have been granted habeas corpus, but they're still sitting in prison because there's nowhere for them to go because none of their original countries that they come from wants them back. So they're in a legal limbo. And the only way they're going to get out, most of them, or a lot of them, is in a coffin.
Wow, that's really terrible.
I believe
when we discussed this, we've discussed that how Attorney General Alberto Gonzalez issued a memo to George W. Bush that called the Geneva Conventions quaint and obsolete.
Yeah.
Quaint and obsolete.
And they can ignore them when they want to interrogate prisoners. In other words, it's basically authorizing torture.
Yeah,
and like you said, the techniques of waterboarding, and on Friday the Guardian exposed another technique that they used, which was in the report actually, which was they would surround the person in cold water. It's another technique to simulate drowning, and it was called water dousing, basically another form of waterboarding.
Well, I'll tell you what. There's a lot more to talk about, and particularly to talk about the application of this in your work. Right now we need to take a break, and we're going to start out with a little promo from my friend Edgar Ahrens, who is a Russian composer living in Moscow.
Okay.
I've worked with Russian composer Edgar Ahrens for quite a few years, building an inventory of songs, many of which feature singer-performer Patricia Welch. We will soon be releasing these songs, components of an album and a musical in progress called Hadley's Castle. When Edgar and I first got together, I was amazed by the brilliance of his musical scores created for movies, TVs, and animations. Here is a sample of the work he did on the Russian TV series, available now on Amazon, called The Secret Agent's Memoir, which had two seasons. This score is called Escape. and was created for the first season. I'm very pleased to say that Bridge of Light Productions, a division of New Galaxy Enterprises, is proud to be the contact point for television and film companies seeking information about this amazing composer's work. If you're in the entertainment business and wish to know more, contact me at johnnybluestar@gmail.com. That's johnnybluestar@gmail.com.
It is the 15th century. El Tesoro de Cielo, a Spanish treasure ship, sends a scouting expedition to a strange island. Golden statues surrounding them prove the enormity of their find. Suddenly, hordes of ghoulish creatures with scaly green flesh and skeletal wings descend upon them from the sky.
What do you think of this, Rufio?
These creatures are fragile, Captain. We can take them with our swords.
They seem supernatural. Who knows what powers they possess?
Fallen angels, weakened by their treason.
My God! Are you saying they're Nephilim, the devil's host?
I'm saying whatever they are, we can take them. Do any of you cowards dare join me?
Up against sharp knife-like nails and hideous fangs, the men's swords rip into slimy green flesh. Though black blood pours copiously from their half-naked bodies, creatures miraculously persist. Can the crew survive this bloody, cursed battle?
Find out more by Googling The Thrice Born, a new sci-fi supernatural novel by Carlos Lopez Avery and Johnny Bluestar. Google with the words Carlos Johnny Kendall, The Thrice Born. That's Carlos Johnny Kendall, The Thrice Born.
New Galaxy Enterprises is a media company specializing in wide-ranging content like novels, nonfiction books, screenplays, commercial advertising, web content, etc. One of our most esteemed providers is illustrator Robert W. Zalo. I work on all my most important projects like book covers, logos, web design elements with Robert. As an illustrator, he worked on the Ignatz-nominated comic book, The Expert's Guide to Killing Things That Go Bump in the Night. His skills encompass advertising, magazine illustrations, gaming, comic books, TV production, and scenic painting. His clients include Comcast, Adelphia, Haven Talent, Forceworks, High Octane Theater, Star Creative Advertising. If you wish to contact Robert, go to johnnybluestar.com and let me know. That's johnnybluestar.com. For artist, illustrator Robert Zalo, an essential component of all the work we do. Maybe he can help you too. I think that Abel Grabe was a dramatic eye-opener for me. And yet I never realized that such brutality could be officially sanctioned. Yet at one point, torture, like we were saying, became a key component in political and judicial type of official governmental activities. But it also became an important component in television, movies, and unfortunately, this trend has not stopped. It makes the days of Dirty Harry look particularly tame. You remember Dirty Harry?
Oh, yeah.
Well, I was brought up that way, you know, by an actual ethical lawyer, it really was disgusting to me.
Yeah.
You know, we're both writers who have entered the publishing game with the objective of social reform. Matter of fact, the book Boots in Manhattan that was promoted before was a book I wrote, part of a series called The Foot Soldier, that kind of contrasts, in part, the experience of a person who's on the ground in war and the mentality of the policy makers, sometimes rapidly divergent. Really strange. Anyway, we're now competing with predatory emulators of government and social wrongdoing in media. I think maybe the first salvo of this predatory interest in the series in torture was the series 24. Homeland continued this media obsession as did many other films and TV programs. Perhaps as disturbing a movie has ever been made, for me, anyway, was Zero Dark Thirty during, I believe, the Obama administration, when they supposedly alleged the type of enhanced interrogation used to find bin Laden. People can say what they want, and the film appeared on many top 10 lists of U.S. film critics, but the film was another strong descent into evangelizing the value of terrible and brutal infringement of human rights. Do you look at your work, Ken, as some kind of antidote to this aberration of media?
Well, at this point, I'm not sure if it's an antidote to this type of media, because the people, my audience who read my books are not necessarily going to be the same ones who are going to go to see these shows or films. I don't like these type of films myself. Like you said, it's people can do whatever they want in their art, but it bothers me that you know, we go down to this simple us or them mentality, and as the American tribe, we're ready to wave the flag and send our basically our kids and grandkids into wars that we don't know anything about. And you infuse patriotism with killing people, and somehow that makes it a heroic thing. Somehow it's okay for a drone to go and assassinate somebody miles and miles away because we don't have to actually see it, and we don't see it. And I've always been bothered that patriotism's always been used by governments to get the public behind a war and things like that. My novels are written in sort of faction, which is fiction that entertains you but teaches you a fact about something. And they have a lot of realism, and they're dialogue-driven, which would make them excellent candidates for films or programs. So if they get into this medium, which I hope they will, perhaps they can be an antidote.
Would you tell us a little bit more about the details of your story, Patriot Act, without maybe giving away all the plot details?
Yeah, well, without spoiling the story, because I can't, you know, do that. But we're basically following the story of a naturalized U.S. citizen who has a normal life and family in Santa Barbara, but he just happens to have been born in Iraq. So when he receives a call from his brother, who still lives in Iraq, saying, "I need your help," of course he drops everything and he goes to help him. But like I said before, when these guys were in the wrong place at the wrong time, he gets captured in a raid by bounty hunters and sold to the United States as a suspected terrorist just because he's in the same room with his brother, who's being suspected as a terrorist himself. So there he's classified as an enemy combatant and thrown into Guantanamo Bay detention camp with basically no, you know, they threw away the key and locked the door. The protagonist of the story is the attorney, Brent Marks, who assists Ahmed to try to get him out of Guantanamo. And there's a few twists to the story that you gotta get it to read it. It's not an easy read, but it's something that everybody should read, especially since, you know, we are living in these times where the government can actually do something like this. Like you said before, you can't believe it. Well, you may not be able to believe it, but the government did do it.
Is the government still doing it? Is what that movie, Dark Zero 30, did that actually happen, do you think? Or is that the government denied it, but the people said, but they also said that these people had unauthorized access to classified material to make it.
You know, I can't say whether it's true or not, because I don't have the research, but, you know, these things do get exposed to WikiLeaks, and then the government is put in an embarrassing position where they say, "Oh, yeah, we did torture some folks," or something like that. Remember when Obama said that? I mean, you know, they can't hide what they did because people are going to talk. For example, there's a guy that I met after I put my book out, after I published A Patriot's Act, guard in Guantanamo to publish a nonfiction book called Murder at Camp Delta, which is basically about three detainees who the government says hung themselves in their cells. But it turns out that they couldn't have hung themselves because they were dead before they were hanging. So he actually witnessed them being taken from Camp Delta to an off-site CIA black ops facility, and then he witnessed when the van brought them back. And when they brought them back, they were not alive. So, you know, this kind of stuff comes out because people see it, and they're not going to just sit, hopefully, they're not just going to sit by and let stuff like this happen.
Wow, it's just really, it's really a terrible situation. You know, do you remember the Talking Bay incident?
Yes, I have, yeah.
Because there's another example of incredible deception, which took us to war, where you presume that you tell the world that there was an attack on one of your ships, and it leads to bombing North Vietnam, but the attack really did not exist, except in the people who engineered this sort of facade.
I think they assume that the American public is just not intelligent enough to figure things out for themselves, which I think is a poor assumption on their part to be made, because they get caught in these situations where people will come up with and expose the actual facts, and you know, but sometimes at great expense to themselves. I'm speaking of Edward Snowden, for example, who said, you know, I'm mad as hell and I'm not going to take it anymore, and I don't care what happens to me. You know, it takes individuals like this to tell us, hey guys, you got blinders on, open your eyes.
You know, to just change the subject for a second, we heard in the last break a song by Stephanie Sylvain, and I have to tell you that this is a UK person, a singer-songwriter that I met on LinkedIn. And, you know, it's like amazing how many wonderful people you can meet, like I did with Edgar Ahrens, who's a Russian composer I work with. Now, she wrote a song called I Love You the Most, which I played the other day. I know that you love me the most. But this song, it actually, since our last broadcast last week, it's become a hit all over the world.
Wow.
In Australia, in Africa, in different places in Africa, in Detroit, in Los Angeles, in France. And I'd like to play this. It's really interesting approach to when you have somebody that you basically is abusing you, and you still want them to love you, and you believe. Here it comes.
I may have marmalade on my toast, and you may have your caviar. I may walk to work in my second-hand shoes, and you drive in your fancy car. I'm down here and you're up there, you're giving me the looks like you don't care. They say love and hate are so very close, so I know that you love me the most. I know by the way you stare at me that deep down inside you care for me. You may drink champagne to my cup of tea, but nobody freaking cares. And you say I ain't the one for you, that I'm way down there beneath the view. Look at what your poor shake's done to you, and nobody freaking cares. She took your money and laughed at you, and then slept with all your mates and they were laughing too. So let's kick her to the curb, yeah, me and you, for nobody freaking cares. And I know you said bad things of me, but deep down inside you care for me. For they say love and hate are so very close, so I know that you love me the most. You took to your drink and your one night stand, so please don't judge me by your own bad hand. You stand up straight, just be the man, for nobody freaking cares. And come down off your mighty horse and take a chance on me, and we'll run the course, and we'll show the bitch we don't do divorce, for nobody freaking cares. And I know you said bad things of me, but deep down inside you care for me. For they say love and hate are so very close,
most. Yes, I know that you love me the most.
The following is from West Side Warrior, the memoir of Ray Boylan, a Korean War veteran and crime fighter. He was there fighting in the world's coldest battlefield when the Chinese communists invaded.
Desperate squad members ran past our foxhole yelling, "Get the hell out of here, there's too many of them!" Again, we saw the Chinese soldiers charging in with opium-induced mindlessness, oblivious of our bullets. Again, we heard the bugles and whistles. Climbing out of our foxhole, Bob dropped two hand grenades behind us, and I threw one over my shoulder. Bullets whizzing by our heads, Bob and I became bolts of lightning flashing across the mountainside. Like a hideous film, desperate scenes like this played out on the Tokong Pass for 3 days. Sometimes I played in the scene. Sometimes I could only watch and wonder if it were real, or if I'd be suddenly jolted out of my trance by an RKO usher saying, "Hey, did you kids sneak in here?"
To acquire this book, Google westsidewarrior.boylan.kindle. Boylan is spelled B-O-Y-L-A-N. That's West Side Warrior, Boylan, Kindle.
This is Johnny Blue Star. I've worked as a lyricist with Patricia Welsh for over 5 years, along with Russian composer Edgar Ahrens, a friend and colleague. Her ability as a singer is simply amazing. She brings a unique and dramatic flair to every song she sings. Over the next few months, we shall be releasing a number of these songs, part of an album called Hadley's Castle. Meanwhile, Patricia has been busy creating a super enjoyable collection of classic standards in an exciting 46-song, 3-CD collection.
Music for great entertaining introduces Cocktails, Dinner, and Dessert with Patricia Welch. 3 hours of continuous music. 46 of the all-time classic standards, spanning decades of hit songs. Going to a friend's home for dinner? Cocktails, Dinner, and Dessert with Patricia also makes the perfect hostess gift. This 3-CD compilation is the perfect background music that sets just the right mood for any dinner party.
I'm crazy for feeling so lonely. There was a boy, a very strange, enchanted boy.
To purchase this album, just go to patriciawelch.com/CD. That is patriciawelch.com/CD. You won't be disappointed. You're back with Kenny Eadie, author, attorney, and environmental activist. I would like to read something from an op-ed piece that was published in the New York Times on June 24, 2012. After speaking about the drone attacks in foreign countries and the deaths included of innocent women and children, which you mentioned before, Ken, the writer said, "Meanwhile, the detention facility at Guantanamo Bay, Cuba, now houses 169 prisoners. About half have been cleared for release, yet little have prospect of ever attaining their freedom. American authorities have revealed that in order to obtain confessions, some of the few being tried only in military courts have been tortured by waterboarding more than 100 times or intimidated with semi-automatic weapons, power drills, or threats to sexually assault their mothers. Astoundingly, these facts cannot be used as a defense by the accused because the government claims they occurred under the cover of, quote, national security. Most of the other prisoners have no prospect of even being charged or tried either. At a time when popular revolutions are sweeping the globe, the United States should be strengthening, not weakening, basic rules of law and principles of justice enumerated in the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. But instead of making the world safer, America's violation of international human rights abets our enemies and alienates our friends." Now, this isn't exactly Daniel Ellsberg or some incredible, astute whistleblower like Snowden. The writer is Jimmy Carter, the 39th president of the United States. Could anything be put clearer than that letter by a former president? Ken, what do you think is happening in our country?
Well, I agree with what President Carter said to Oprah Winfrey in the interview. which is that democracy is dead and that the U.S. is now being run by an oligarchy. You know, President Carter's pointed out that our country is being run by a small group of rich elite people who use the government for their own aims. And part of the way they use the government is with the military-industrial complex. Basically, they can go send this war machine out to fight private battles. You know, when we see this in foreign policy, where the United States uses military aid to arm insurgent groups and overthrow governments, like just happened in the Ukraine, where it installed its own people in the Ukrainian government. I'm speaking of Natalie Jaresko, who was a top State Department official, and now she's the Minister of Finance in the Ukraine. And Hunter Biden, Vice President Biden's son, is sitting on one of the boards of the biggest gas company in Ukraine. And we're seeing it happen in Syria, and we're seeing it happen in Iraq. And how do we justify that, and how do we justify their use of torture when it's banned by international law? I don't think it can be justified. I think we have to stand up and say enough is enough, and this has to stop. I've spent a lot of time living outside the United States myself, and I can tell you that when the Iraq war was happening, people would come up to me and say, well, are you for or against this? And I would say, look, I'm against it because, you know, it's not being prosecuted in my name. But back home, people were flying flags, and they were just blind to the fact of what was going on. I think that Europeans have always had great respect for people from the States and the American dream and the constitutional principles. But now, unfortunately, the U.S. is not practicing their own ideals, and it's breaking my heart.
Yes, it's like really the wrong message to send to the rest of the world. And you know, there's an old Greek saying, the word is the shadow of the deed. And the fact that we can continually proclaim freedom, liberty, and democracy and practice these certain things throws a great shadow on our flag. And it's very, very sad. And
of course, if we're running into a place and we're saying, you know, in the name of democracy, we're doing this and we're torturing and killing people, what are we doing in the name of democracy, you know?
And the amount of innocent people who die as a result of some of these practices is probably, you know, since the Iraq War, in the certainly the hundreds of thousands of people who died for just being in the wrong place, just like those prisoners in Guantanamo are picked up for the wrong reasons, and they're in the wrong place, and who cares? Well, we should care.
Exactly, and now in Syria, we've created a refugee problem when we send hundreds of thousands of people who have no homes to Europe, who can't even afford to take them in.
And yeah, it is very, very sad.